Great, thank you. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. This is June 24, 2020. We're at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have our second case on the calendar this morning. I'll have the marshal call the case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding. And this is A200029, Herbs Boomin Fireworks, LLC versus John J. Muhar.
All right, counsel, just a few notes before you begin today. I'm going to ask you to mute your microphone if you are not speaking so we don't get any feedback through the WebEx. The marshal, you can see on the screen, is showing a running clock of your time. Please keep an eye on your time. Before you begin your argument, please identify yourself and your client. Each party will have 15 minutes for oral argument, and the appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall. I represent appellants Irv Seeley, a Leech Lake Ojibwe band member, and Irv's Booming Fireworks, a reservation business. We seek reversal of both aspects of the district court's ruling, subject matter jurisdiction, that's addendum 5 through 7, and failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted, addendum 7. The standard of review is de novo. In this case, the claim is about the state exceeding its statutory authority by threatening prosecution of legal acts. It involves the statutory interpretation of Minnesota Statute 624.23, the phrase, "Nothing in these sections shall be construed to prohibit the possession or sale of any kind of fireworks by shipment directly out of the state." As to the district court's arguments and cited cases, addendum 5 through 7, this is on subject matter jurisdiction, we don't necessarily disagree that the prosecutor has immunity from a charging decision based on alleged illegal acts. But those cases don't apply here because appellant claims that the state has threatened prosecution for legal acts. The county's arguments in the brief are similarly unpersuasive. The private cause of action that the appellants have is Minnesota Statute 466.02, which reads in the Tort Claims Act, "Every municipality, which is defined to include counties, is subject to liability for its torts and those of its officers, employees, and agents acting within the scope of their employment or duties, whether arising out of a governmental or proprietary function." With respect to the tort, as the court knows, Walsh v. U.S. Bank, the 2014 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, said notice pleading was required. A fair reading of the complaint indicates that the claim is that there's a tribal permit to sell high explosive fireworks and that the threatened prosecution interferes with the permit, the property interest in the permit, contracts, and customer relationships, all guard variety torts in Minnesota.
Counsel, seems to me the most critical issue is whether the district court had the ability to interpret the statute, if you will, before the county sought to bring any kind of enforcement proceeding against your client. What's the most opposite legal authority for your assertion that the complaint that you seeking to interpret a statute before a prosecuting attorney seeks to enforce it states a justiciable claim?
I'll do my best to answer how I understand the question, is that because we have a private cause of action, the state legislature has authorized in 466.02 that the county is subject to liability for its torts. And so when the state legislature authorizes a private cause of action to sue the county and the tort is as described, then the court has the authority to interpret the law because the state legislature has authorized the court to do that. And there are many, many cases under the Minnesota Tort Claims Act where the courts have interpreted statutes in determining whether there's tortious interference. And also interpretation of, I should mention, ordinances as well. With respect to the justiciable controversy issue under Chapter 505, that was addressed by the first panel decision, and I just wanted to read one sentence. It's quoted on page 15. But the first panel said in the 2018 decision at page 2, first, appellant's declaratory judgment action involves a definite and concrete assertion of a right to sell fireworks emanating from a legal source, the permit to sell fireworks. So there's a recognition of a property right there. So with the recognition of the property right, then we look at, you know, is this a prototypical declaratory judgment action? And it is, because, you know, the typical one, of course, would be contract. I think the other side breached. I'm worried if I don't perform, I'm going to be accused of a breach. So you can go to court and get a remedy before you stop performing under the contract. Here, it's similar in that we have a similarity is we have a permit that grants rights like a contract. A third party is interfering with the exercise of the rights under the permit. But as the earlier panel said, you know, these are concrete rights under the permit, so it needs to be addressed. So then we...
Counsel, my concern is this is a criminal statute, correct? That you're asking that the district court in this declaratory judgment action interpret, correct? Whether that statute that says you cannot sell explosive fireworks with the exception of to people out of state, that the interpretation of that statute is something that is within the district court's jurisdiction. That's essentially your argument, correct?
Yes, it's incidental to litigating the tort under 466.02. So the court has subject matter jurisdiction because of 466.02. And incidental to that jurisdiction would be interpreting the statute. Because obviously,
if we agree with you that in pursuit of your tort action, that we would issue or the district court had jurisdiction to declare what that statute means, I mean, wouldn't that invite pre-enforcement declaratory judgment actions that could really disturb prosecutorial functioning?
The 466.02 authorizes tort litigation against the county. The rules of civil procedure protect the county from claims, you know, sort of the outrageous claims that, you know, this criminal statute violates my civil rights or violates my rights according to a property interest or according to a contract. So the protection that the county seeks is found in the rules of civil procedure. When the county threatens to prosecute legal acts interfering with property rights and contracts, that's tortious. And from our point of view, fortunately, the state legislature has granted the court subject matter jurisdiction under 466.02. I might add, although not before the court, the state legislature has a list of 25 exceptions in 466.03, and the county is asserting an exception that's not listed. And we believe that subdivision 6 of 466.03 regarding discretionary acts, that the county attorney does not have discretion to threaten prosecution for legal acts. The discretion comes for illegal acts. And here, the argument of my client is that the statute legally authorizes the activity, which is different than most criminal statutes. So going to the next point, I was reading an interview of, I think, the chief judge or the former chief judge, and I thought it was my duty to point out to the court that this is an important decision for Indian Territory and for American Indians in Minnesota generally, that the decision on subject matter jurisdiction is worthy of a published decision. If the state court were to agree with the county and hold that there's no judicial review of pre-charging interpretations by the government of state and tribal law, we want to know. If the court isn't going to have judicial review, then American Indians' businesses were interfered with such threats of prosecution for legal activities, will have to seek an alternative forum, the tribal court or the federal court. With respect to dismissal for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, the statutory interpretive question is properly before the court. We made the statutory interpretive arguments in the district court. We made them in the appellate brief. The appellate court here has a decision, which we quote at page 22, Palladium Holdings, it's in a footnote. Appellate courts cannot assume a district court erred by failing to address a motion, and silence on a motion is therefore treated as an implicit denial of the motion. So we can assume that our arguments were rejected by the district court because they weren't addressed, but they were properly pled. And so I won't go through the arguments with respect to the definition of state and shipment because the government's response brief did not address them. But at pages 30 through 43, we very carefully, on behalf of an American Indian business in Minnesota, go through why state would include the reservation. We cite to a Michigan case, which is one of our neighbors to the north. We have a common boundary. And we go through the Michigan case and how important it is for our appellate courts not to treat tribes as local governments. Tribes are, in a way, sovereign nations. They are not like cities. They're not like townships. They need to be treated by respect by the courts and by the state legislature. And for the state legislature to skip that point, I think is not good. So we need to respect the tribes. And then finally, with respect to shipment, pages 43 through 46, under Uniform Commercial Code 2.504, which is adopted in Minnesota, a shipment includes customers picking up, in this case, the fireworks. So for these reasons, I believe that the lower court decision should be reversed. The court should make the statutory interpretive argument that we've argued and the government has waived. And I think that's what we're looking for from the court. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you, Mr. Cardall. Mr. Haig, just one moment while we get the clock reset. All right, go ahead, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Haig, Chief Assistant Itasca County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the defendants. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak today about the prosecution function and the independence of that component of government power. It's one of the three components we have for the peace, the safety, the welfare, the happiness of people. And that's what the people wanted, and reflected it in the Constitution, and wanted to have a division so that each branch member, the official responsible for carrying out effective functions, doesn't step over the line and do the other's function. And existing jurisprudence in Minnesota, cited by the district court, speaks to the prosecution's independence. That's what it is at the crux of this case.
Mr. Haig, I understand and I read your brief. What I'm struggling with is the fact that it's the court's role to interpret the law. And so I'm struggling with how a county attorney's prosecutory authority is, or discretion, is implicated by an action that simply seeks a court determination of what a statute means.
Not that simple, Your Honor. This action, before charging, is a challenge to the correctness of the judgment, the interpretation of the elected official elected by the people who serves public's interest in government power. He doesn't represent the individuals. He represents the government's power. That's what this action is. It is seeking to review a pre-charging mental analysis, an analysis of the federal statute that talks about Indian reservations in Minnesota, transfers criminal enforcement from the federal government to the state. And that statute is Public Law 280. And that's a local prosecutor's job. The Constitution says prosecution, judgments regarding prosecutions, whether to prosecute or not, is core to the executive function. That's what Crotzer holds. The other cases, the criminal cases cited by the district court, the court also talked about the reserve mining cases and the cases that followed reserve mining about keeping separateness so that the judicial branch doesn't take on a category of cases that belong, this belongs exclusively with executive function.
If the facts were different here, if the appellants had proceeded to sell explosive fireworks to Minnesota state residents and Itasca County prosecuted, would the court have subject matter jurisdiction to interpret the statute on any appeal from the convictions?
Yes, absolutely. And I discussed that in our brief.
So it's simply a timing. So the problem here is that declaratory relief was sought before the county actually charged the appellants.
That is, I think that's at the crux of this. No statute gives an individual the right to seek review of a pre-charging interpretive process and judgment reached by the county attorney. Chapter 388 creates that of office, defines it, defines rights and responsibilities, gives no private citizen a statutory cause of action to go into the district court and then have the district court decide who can be charged, who the prosecutor may or may not charge, what conduct a prosecutor may or may not charge.
Is that what this complaint is seeking a declaration of? I thought the complaint really hinges on what the meaning of 624.23 is. And doesn't the Declaratory Judgment Act, in fact, provide the vehicle for a party to seek a declaration of what a statute means?
Absent a statute, the answer to that question is no. We cite the case Alliance for Metropolitan Stability, and discuss that decision. It's a Court of Appeals decision. The Declaratory Judgment Action does not create a private cause of action. It doesn't. And counsel's discussion of 466.02 for torts, that doesn't apply here. There's no tort stated in the complaint. No claim for relief for torts, no damages. It simply seeks a declaration and nothing more. It cites no statute enabling the district court to review this executive function. And that's what the district court analyzed. This and counsel talked about, well, it's akin to a contract. There is no contract between an elected county attorney and each of the 45,000 members of the public in Itasca County. It just doesn't exist. And was there something wrongful or tortious? No, there wasn't.
So, counsel, I'd like you to direct your comments, if you would, to Mr. Cardle's argument that this is a situation where his client is entitled to interpretation of this statute, you know, regardless of whether they would generally be allowed to have interpretation of a criminal statute. Here they hold a permit from the tribe, and that puts them in a different position, more like the situation, and we get them all the time, where the courts are asked to interpret a contract in light of a statute, right? Private parties enter into a contract, and then the court is asked to interpret the contract in light of statutory requirements. Here we have a permit issued by the tribe to the plaintiff in this case, and yet we have a criminal statute. So doesn't that put us in the position of the Declaratory Judgment Act, where there are, is a clear justiciable controversy?
No. No, it doesn't. The tribe's not a party to this action.
I'm not asking about the tribe. I'm asking about the plaintiff in this case, because they're the ones that hold the permit.
He holds a permit. He alleges the existence of a permit. He alleges that the permit allows this, the retail sale of high explosives or explosive fireworks to Minnesotans who live off the reservation. That's what he alleges. Your Honors, even his own application that is in the record states that the individual will abide by all applicable laws. Minnesota's criminal laws are applicable. They are there to protect the peace, the welfare, the security of Indians, just as they are non-Indians. The federal law says that. It transfers criminal jurisdiction to the states. Under the statutes, the state entrusts that government, that component of government power to the elected county attorney, able to use his independent judgment. If this court decides to expand the jurisprudence, the existing jurisprudence, reduce the independence of the prosecutor, he'll have to think twice before, how is the Court of Appeals going to review my legal analysis and judgments before I make a judgment call, what I'm entrusted to do. I've got to do it for the public. Now I've got to answer to individual citizens on top of that.
Mr. Hick, I want to redirect your attention to one of the other arguments that Mr. Cardall advanced in his brief, and that is that this court has already decided the question of subject matter jurisdiction, I think, in the second appeal, and that we should say that it is the law of the case and the district court erred by failing to recognize that.
That's not what the Court of Appeals held. The Court of Appeals did rule there was justiciability. Justiciability and subject matter jurisdiction are wholly distinct. They are not one in the same. Subject matter jurisdiction, as pointed out by the district court, concerns the court's a category of cases. Is it a category of case that the court even has the power to review and decide? That was not even discussed or analyzed by the Court of Appeals in that decision.
Well, isn't that true? Isn't that true because in October of 2017, this court issued an order, in fact, denying the respondent's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
And that ruling did not reach the subject matter jurisdiction issue. Its ruling was tied to explicitly to the rules of procedure that allowed the court to review the denial of a preliminary injunction. And the court said, it made a point of noting, they noted there's other issues. They noted that the district court had already told the briefing, but the Court of Appeals stated, Judge Cleary said, maybe that, you know, note that you can still proceed despite this interlocutory appeal. And so this is the first time the court is reaching subject matter jurisdiction. It is now front and center, and it has not been decided. So with that, Your Honor, we do respectfully submit that the district court properly looked at existing jurisprudence and properly concluded this is not a case for to interpret statutes. It's you are bringing a suit against somebody who represents the public, and it does take resource. It takes immense resource to litigate these issues, and it does not belong in this forum. And I don't have the answer.
Counsel, I do see that your time has expired. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Haig. Just one moment, Mr. Cardo, while we reset the clock. Can we reset the clock to 5 minutes, please? Oops, just a moment. Great, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Cardle.
My focus on the rebuttal is will be the importance of this case and why there should be a published decision, and the alternative decision-making process that's being proposed by the government. So if we look at the government's position, the county attorney does not want judicial review. Here, the county attorney, according to the court's decision, sent a representative to the tribe to tell IRV and other firework permit holders that selling explosive fireworks would be a criminal violation. The description of that method used by the county attorney is at pages 3 through 4 and page 9 of the brief. The county attorney acknowledges that there are difficult interpretations of tribal law, federal law, and requirements of interpreting the permit, and also, of course, interpreting state law. And page 9.
I appreciate that, Mr. Cardle, and, you know, obviously the merits, to get to the merits, one has to decide that this declaratory judgment action is a valid cause of action over which the district court has subject matter jurisdiction. Are you aware of any precedent which suggests that that a party can obtain relief under the declaratory judgment statute in the form of a judicial interpretation of a criminal law?
I don't have, I guess there are some tortious interference cases against municipalities under 466.02, which involve interpreting laws, land use controls, and whether they have criminal prohibitions, I can't recall. But there is tortious interference claims that this court has recognized against municipalities that require interpretation of ordinances and statutes, and probably somewhere in there, there are criminal prohibitions because land use control ordinances have those. So with respect to the county attorney doesn't want judicial review for his interpretations of state, federal, and tribal law, which are very complicated decisions. In fact, saying that having the courts involved would disrupt the stability. And here, again, 466.02 says every municipality, which includes counties, is subject to liability for its torts.
Counsel, I don't even see in your complaint a reference to the statute that you're citing now. The complaint, as I'm looking at it, maybe I'm looking at a wrong version, is all about seeking a declaration of what the fireworks sales statutes mean. Am I missing something?
Oh, yeah, I thought that everyone knew that the Minnesota State Tort Acts claim creates a private cause of action to sue counties. So, yeah, I mean, under Walsh v. U.S. Bank 2014, it's notice pleading. We pled the allegations for a tortious interference claim. We didn't reference 466.02, but why would we have to? It's a private cause of action that's existed for decades. And the county knows that because the counties routinely get sued under 466.02. And my concern here is that we're being treated differently because we're an American Indian business on a reservation. And so we look at the method they're using, the claims they don't want to have judicial review, the conflict with 466.02. Why wouldn't an American Indian business on a reservation have the same benefits of statute 466.02 as any other business? And it's so peculiar, these page numbers that I've mentioned. Oh, this is complicated. The county attorney needs to interpret state and federal and tribal law, and we don't want to have judicial review. Well, this is stuff that happens every day in municipalities, and municipal zoning officers get challenged. And so why can't we, as an American Indian business on a reservation, challenge a county attorney in court? And again, if the county attorney's threats of prosecution based on misinterpretations of law aren't going to be handled under the Declaratory Judgment Act and for the Minnesota Tort Claims Act, then we're going to have to seek another forum. But it seems obvious this is the forum.
So Mr. Cardle, thank you. I appreciate that answer, and I just am seeing your time dwindle. And I had one factual question for you. So the permits that you have included in the addendum, the fireworks permits 3 and 4, exhibits 3 and 4, they're dated 2015 and 2017. Are they each like 1 year permits, or how did that work? I assume you know that.
I think they're 1 year permits.
Okay. And have you any allegations with regard to what's happened in more recent time? I mean, I know you asserted this claim some time ago.
No, I don't know if the tribe's still issuing permits or not.
Okay.
My client wants one. That I know. Okay.
I see that your time is up, Mr. Cardo. Are there any other questions from the panel? No. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel. I appreciate your cooperation and your flexibility in these challenging times, participating in this oral argument via WebEx. This matter was well briefed and argued. We will take the matter under advisement and we'll issue an order in due course. We'll stand in recess until our third case later in the morning.